You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. On the campus of the University of Houston, Students United for Peace held an anti-war demonstration yesterday. Planning the event was an uphill battle. It's bush country, and promotional flyers and banners were torn down. Still, a diverse collection of 14 student groups signed on to co-sponsor the demonstration, and many students that encountered the event responded positively. Today, Honor Brown of the Houston Independent Media Center and Renee Feltz of Pacifica Station KPFT bring us the voices of students and speakers at the event.
As a female, I see no good in the consequences of war. And I do not understand the casualties of war. I believe that war is an act of violence ending in death and hatred with no resolution, and I stand firm in my opposition to war. As a feminist, I know no justification for the causes of war, and I will challenge its occurrence. As a feminist, I cannot and will not stand aside while the president plots bomb markers on a map over a game of golf. As a feminist, I not only stand firm in my opposition to war, I use my voice to spread awareness to the people around me and believe in the perseverance of my sisters and brothers to do the same in the name of peace and solidarity.
When President Bush declared that we were going to wage war against terrorism and asked Americans for their support, we should have asked ourselves, whose war is this? Who's going to benefit from this war and who's going to be affected by this war?
A surplus of jobs where people were literally looking for good employees. Now we got 2 million people unemployed. Can I get a witness up in here? Stock market gone down. People stop talking about the privatization of Social Security now. Have you noticed the mood and the attitude in this country? And notice how he flipped the script on you. He went from following Al-Qaeda, and searching for Osama bin Laden, and then while the nation was still in mourning, September 11th anniversary, he gives a speech on the 12th, he flips the script and then tells you it's Iraq now. What happened to Osama? Where's the caveman now? I'm looking for him. Where's Al-Qaeda?
There are war makers in this country and elsewhere that want to kill people. Yeah, they want oil, but not unless they get to kill some people too. Yeah, they want power and money, but they won't solve it peacefully, no matter what they're offered. They're insisting on war. The CIA told Congress straight up, the only way that Saddam will become a terrorist threat to the US is if we attack him. And Congress decided, all right, let's attack anyway. Not just Republicans, Democrats too. They want to kill you guys, but not Sheila Jackson Lee. She stood up for peace, and we all need to thank Sheila. These war makers want your money, too. This war is supposed to cost up to $3 trillion. They already spend half the budget on war. Imagine if you had a friend who spent half his paycheck on guns and security guards and alarm systems and stuff. He's making several hundred bucks a week, and half of it went into weapons and security. And out of the other half, he'd be trying to pay off his rent and his debt on his credit cards for weapons he bought in the past. But he wouldn't have enough food or medical insurance, and he'd ask why, and he'd say, these robbers and killers, they want to attack me. And you look at his house with all the burglar bars and the sentries walking back and forth, and he'd be up there behind bulletproof glass eating a ramen noodles. And you call up to him, hey man, this is a lot to spend on security. And he shuts down, yeah, maybe so, but I gotta spend 9 times more than I'm currently spending to deal with this new threat. And you answer, but you don't have enough money for that. And he'd say, well, I'll get into more debt if I have to. After 9/11, the whole world thought of us as victims. Now the whole world thinks we're nuts, and we are. I went to see U.S. Representative Culberson with my friends at his town hall meeting and asked him some tough questions about the war, and he sounded like a lunatic. We asked him, how can we afford $3 trillion on war when we can't even pay for health care for our people? He said, it's quite possible that during the time it took to ask that question, Saddam has developed a new delivery system to blow up you and your family here in Houston. And then he said, you don't need health care if you're dead. This is not some late night talk radio maniac. This is our representative from Spring Branch.
How do you feel about the rally today?
I think it's really exciting because there's really, at U of H there tends to be a really complacent attitude. There seems to be a very, this is my fifth year here, and there's never been anything somewhat political on campus, and I've seen probably 4 or 5 different events. We're set up directly against like either the Bush administration or the war, the impending war, and so it's really exciting to see U of H students get excited about politics, because I think that's important. I think a lot of people, like a lot of the things that I've been hearing today have been about, well, what, how does this serve or disserve our interest? And I think, like, for me, like, the biggest thing is that going to war isn't looking at humanity. It assumes that some people are less human than others, and that some people, that some innocent lives are less valuable than others, and I think that's wrong.
So how did you hear about the rally today?
I'm a student at U of H. Here, been hearing about it for 2 weeks, been in the paper, been all over campus about it.
And how do you feel about it?
You know, I didn't agree with everything they had to say, but I don't agree with the war in Iraq. I don't agree on everyone's tactics and politics behind their reasons, but you know, I have my reasons, they have theirs. And it was kind of just, it was good. I mean, everybody got together and kind of expressed how they felt.
Is there anything at the rally that you heard that most resonates in your mind that you know, you're going to take with you that's sort of lingering in your thoughts?
For one, I didn't realize that the cost of the war would run around $3 trillion. And the poem that one sister read about the moments of silence that we should give other people, I realized that as Americans, we have a false sense of security and a false sense of superiority when it comes to dealing with other nations. And that poem really made me think about the fact that we don't think about other nations. All we do is think about ourselves. We're very selfish people and very materialistic. We're very individualistic people. And we think about only ourselves and not other nations. And other people have suffered at our hands. And we have blood on our hands, but the only people we think about is ourselves. So I think we need to focus on thinking about other victims and other people that we oppress on the globe.
It's Salima Pir Muhammad, and I'm with Students United for Peace.
So what do you feel was accomplished here today in the rally?
If nothing else, we at least got contact out there, and we got our name, and we're hoping to have further action and further demonstration. And so I think it's important to at least get together on some aspect and on some level. And it's great to hear people from diverse groups speak about something that we can all understand, you know. Obviously, my position is anti-war, but I think the primary aspect of war is that you cannot expect peace out of war, and that violence and retribution is not justice. It's not, and it can't be justified.
That report from Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Washington, D.C. reporter Russell Mokiber and programmer at WPFW is also the editor of the Washington, D.C.-based Corporate Crime Reporter. He publishes Ari and I, briefings on the Arab world from George Bush's press secretary, Ari Fleischer. We asked him about these White House press briefings. Russell, you've been verbally sparring with the Bush administration over its Iraq war agenda. A couple of weeks ago, you confronted White House spokesman Ari Fleischer about Bush's intentions for regime change in Iraq. You recall that?
Yes.
Well, we have that exchange. Let's listen.
Russell. You've said the president wants regime change in Iraq, by which I take it to mean the president wants to overthrow the government in Iraq. Why don't you just say the president wants to overthrow the government in Iraq?
Russell, I think you need to address your question to the hundreds of members of Congress who in 1998 voted for regime change as America's policy and to President Clinton who signed it into law. Sarah?
If I could follow up, Ari.
Go ahead.
You used the term regime change. Why don't you say we want to overthrow the government of Iraq?
Because I described the law as the law was described when it passed and as it's been commonly referred to.
Second question, Ari.
Third.
Second, India adopted the Bush administration's policy on preemptive attack vis-a-vis, let's say, Pakistan, or if China adopted the Bush administration's policy on preemptive attack vis-a-vis Taiwan, would you consider that a lawful policy under international law?
Well, I think what's different is the unique history of Iraq and the irrationality of Iraq. Different policies work in different regions of the world, and different doctrines work at different times and in different regions because of the local circumstances. Policies of containment work more with a rational figure than with an irrational one. That's why the policy containment worked vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. Iraq, on the other hand, given its military history, given the amount of weaponry that Iraq has acquired that they have actually used to invade their neighbors, to attack their neighbors, to launch missiles against their neighbors, has not been deterred by such policies in the past. Given the fact that an irrational leader who has a history of military force and military use and military aggression and domination may acquire a nuclear weapon, the question is, should it be the policy of the United States to do nothing and allow such a leader to acquire a weapon that he could then use to blackmail the world and blackmail the region and even use it to harm us.
So, were you satisfied with that response that you got from Ari Fleischer?
Well, first of all, Verna, I have to say that I do have some sympathy for anybody in that position because they can't say what they mean. And he means by regime change, we're going to overthrow the government of Iraq. If he came out and said that, then on its face, people would have to start thinking, you know, what are we doing in the business of overthrowing governments?
Mm-hmm.
There was a similar problem earlier in the year when there were a group of Colombian journalists in the room. And Ari had said a couple press conferences earlier that it's the policy of the United States not to engage in coups of any kind. So I said, Ari, you said that it's policy of the United States not to engage in coups of any kind. And then I went down the list of all the coups that we've engaged in,
yes.
Chile and mm-hmm. Guatemala and Iran, and mm-hmm. I had a list ready.
Right, right.
And so are you saying that we've changed our policy?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, usually I get no sympathy from the Washington Press Corps, and I didn't on this either, but the Colombians thought it was hilarious, and they cracked up laughing because they understood,
right, right.
Coming from our hemisphere, mm-hmm. that this has been the American policy all along, and it hasn't changed.
Well, it's important. You said you'd get no sympathy from the Washington Press Corps, and but it's important to get some sort of feedback or cooperation, right. because that's how you really nail the administration into responding right. to the tough questions. If you're only given one or two opportunities to question and then a follow-up, but if another reporter comes in and follows up with a different variation of the same question, then you may actually get some serious meaty responses from the spokespeople.
Right. Well, and again, when I say I get no sympathy from the Washington Press Corps, no overt showings, signs, mm-hmm. but my guess is, given the types of questions being asked, there is probably, you know, a 50-50 split in mm-hmm. in that room, those 30 reporters in that room, about whether we should engage in a unilateral attack on Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
It might be higher against, given, you know, the types of questions those reporters are asking. And so, you know, we can't pigeonhole it, but you know, my guess is that there is real hostility in that room to this administration and the way they're operating.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
That is surprising.
Well,
you certainly don't see it in the reports.
Don't see it in the reports, but when you're there and if you watch it, the TV news reporters are mm-hmm. actually more against this war than the print reporters. That's my sense of it.
So how much influence do you think you have, you and the other reporters that are probably against the administration going to this war, how much influence do you think you have by raising these difficult questions to Ari Fleischer at these briefings?
Approaching zero, but the you do what you can do. I mean, one of the things that haunts me is when I decide whether I'm going to go through the rigmarole of trying to get in to these things, and there's a whole history of this where I don't have a White House press pass. I've applied for one.
Mm-hmm.
It's been over a year. They told me that they would get back to me within a month with a yes or no answer because you got to go through the process of Secret Service and so forth. And I just been ignored for over a year. So what I have to do is I go with my congressional press pass and I try to get cleared in every day. And if it's going to be on CNN Live or if they don't want to face the question, they'll just let me sit at the gate. And that's mm-hmm. happened a lot. So, but the thing that haunts me is...
Wait, do you have to submit your question ahead of time?
No, you don't have to submit the question ahead of time, but you have to be cleared in. If you have a White House press pass, you get in.
You said if they don't want to confront the question. I thought maybe that actually submit the question. They know what questions are coming from you, in other words.
No, I think they know that there are certain reporters who are going to ask certain questions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, you know, if they don't want to face it, they can let you sit at the gate, mm-hmm. which I've, you know... There have been 10 times this year where I just sat there and I couldn't get in.
Mm.
So there is that. But I am haunted by the fear that, I should be going there and confronting whenever I get a chance, whether it has an impact or not, just mm-hmm. for my own conscience and to try and put this out. Now, these questions and answers I put up on the www.commondreams.com website, and so I get a lot of feedback from all around the world of people suggesting questions that I should ask, and you know, making comments on the mm-hmm. question and answers.
Mm-hmm. You've been pretty busy these days. I hear that you've written on your website that you spent some time at the American Enterprise Institute, a major conservative think tank in Washington, D.C., earlier this week. And you described the American Enterprise Institute as engineering the political economy. What influence has the AEI and other such organizations had on marketing the president's war against Iraq?
Well, it's been very destructive. Gene Kirkpatrick, Bob Bork, a bunch of leading conservative Republicans are in charge there, and the idea is to dominate the airwaves, to dominate the op-ed pages, to dominate the quote unquote political economy, so as to create facts on the ground and create a reality to make this war easier to execute. And so went over there to get a sense of what it was like. And it was quite disturbing. I thought a lot of what was being said there during these three sessions during the day, not just about the war, not about the war at all, actually. One was on predatory lending. One was on why imperialism is a good thing. If most Americans understood that that's the kind of thing that's being said there, they wouldn't agree with it. They would object to it, and they would think it's out of bounds. But they push the limits because they want to create a different political economy here to make it easier for their corporate funders to operate without criticism. Mm.
So if the American Enterprise Institute is helping to re-engineer the political climate, it seems like, depending on which polls you believe, President-elect George W. is very popular. Why do you think Bush and or his policies are so popular? I guess they're the American Enterprise Institute and others.
Well, they help define the debate. I mean, if Pacifica Radio and WPFW had a greater presence here in Washington, people were listening to us as opposed to watching CNN and Fox and so forth, there would be a different reality in the polls. But I think, you know, 9/11 had a lot to do with it. People got scared. Bush and Cheney took advantage of it. Prior to 9/11, this would not have happened. But things are starting to change. I think we're seeing it in the demonstrations. I think, you know, the majority of American people now are opposed to unilateral attack on Iraq if it involves body bags. That's clear from the polls. And I'm worried about what's going to happen today in the election. But again, it presents opportunities for organizing and to push the corporate duopoly out and create something different.
At the risk of sounding like a pessimist, it doesn't seem to really matter much at this point what the American public feels about going to war with Iraq or not, because the place where it would have made a difference is in the elections. Of course, we'll have to wait and see the results from today's elections. But the candidates, many of them, seem to have calculated that they could go ahead, many Democrats I'm speaking of, and vote with the president, and you know, regardless of the calls and emails they were getting into their office, and that they not suffer in the polls as a result of making that decision.
Well, I thought the turning point, I think you're right, and the turning point was when Gephardt went to the White House and stood up with the president. Mm-hmm. The day after that, he held a press conference. I ran up to the Hill. I was there. It was going out live on C-SPAN. And Richard Gephardt called on me, and that morning in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch was an editorial, lead editorial, saying, Gephardt Caves, that was the title. And they said they thought the reason he did it was because he wants to be speaker and he wants to be president. So I just point blank asked him, do you want to be speaker? I read that to mm-hmm. him. And I said, do you want to be speaker and do you want to be president? And he just snapped and said, that's irrelevant. But I think it is very irrelevant that this mm-hmm. this was a political calculation. Now, I think it was the wrong political calculation. I think Paul Wellstone, before he died, was showing that it was the wrong political calculation, that he came out against the war and he was going to win that election coming out against the war. I think the The prime minister in Germany showed it was the wrong calculation when he came out against the war and he won the election pushing that agenda. The Democrats didn't have the courage of their convictions and they punted and they're going to lose for it, unfortunately.
Russell Mokhiber's exchanges with George Bush's press secretary, Ari Fleischer, are published on www.commondreams.org. Well, although some critics describe singer-musician Michael Franti as a rap artist, anyone attending his concerts can hear the influences of R&B, jazz, reggae, and, of course, rap and hip-hop. Franti hails from Oakland, California, and was adopted at birth by white parents who lived in a predominantly black community in the Bay Area. As an artist, Franti has addressed the issues of homelessness, police brutality, AIDS, the death penalty, and war. Reporter Dred Scott Keyes of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York spoke with Michael Franti during an appearance at the North Sea Jazz Festival in The Hague.
Well, we started in 1994. I used to have another band called the Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy, which is a very aggressive political hip-hop group. And I found that, you know, we were quite successful. We sold quite a few records and toured around the world, but it was always about anger, you know. And I realized at a certain point that if I really wanted to talk about all the things I wanted to talk about in my music, that it would require covering the full rainbow of human emotion. And so that's why we started Spearhead, was to try to cover all bases.
Is your work being heard worldwide now? Are you satisfied with your audience, and who is your audience?
My audience, I guess, are people who have open ears and open minds and open hearts. And we travel all over the world. You know, we don't get played on mainstream radio or on MTV. We do it by word of mouth. You know, and so I feel very proud of the audience that we have, because they're all people who heard about it from a friend, and I think of the music that I recommend to my friends, it's few and far between, so I feel lucky when somebody recommends us to a friend.
And you seem to have a very close rapport with your audience, and it shows.
I appreciate the fact that people are willing to come and see what we do and pay attention to the ideas in the music. So after every show, I walk out off the stage into the audience and hug and greet as many people as I can.
Very nice touch, I got to say that. How do you see your role as in culture, and how do you see culture in its role?
I think culture is the thing that you know, makes us, you know, culture is the expression of our faith, really. You know, it's the expression of our devotion to whatever beliefs that we have, and it's an artistic representation of those beliefs. And it appears in our food, it appears in our dance and our music, our songs. And you know, a prime example of that is that you know, if you look at what American culture is, it's about money. And so that's what you see in our in the art a lot of times in America. But if you look around the world, you see faith in a lot of other things and hope in a lot of other things. And that's what makes the beauty of the that bouquet of cultures. And that's why I feel it's so important that we study and we learn and appreciate and respect other cultures.
Now, Michael, what is your last album and what is your future album?
Our last album is called Stay Human, and it's an album that's a narrative. The entire album is a story. It's about a fictitious court case of a woman who's on death row and a judge who's trying to get her executed, and the judge feels like if he executes her on the eve of the election that he'll win the election, and sure enough, he executes her, they win the election, and they come to find out the next day that they've executed the wrong person. People have asked me, why didn't you, you know, do it on a real case? Like, for example, I've been very outspoken about Mumia Abu-Jamal, and the reason I didn't just do it at just about one case is I didn't want to try to prove to the world that one person was innocent. I wanted to try to show that the whole system is guilty.
One of the songs that you did was very political, and you talked about peace and militarism, defeating militarism. Tell us about that song, how it was composed.
Well, the lyrics say, we can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. And it came about right after the September 11th attack, and the whole United States was up in this patriotic fervor talking about we're going to go on the warpath and get the enemy. And I was trying to think, well, how do we know who the enemy is? And how is it, why is it that these whoever has done this attack, it chose the Pentagon the World Trade Center and was maybe going for the White House. Symbols. You know, this is not for a reason, and I think it's important that people in America and people around the world begin to pay attention to those types of things. Like Martin Luther King said, peace is not just the absence of war, it's the presence of justice. So if we're not fighting for justice around the world, then we're going to continue to have these types of attacks, you know. So I end the song by saying power to the peaceful.
Please tell me the reasons behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation, in the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, said there is no other choice. God bless the children who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Oh, we may even find the solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.
Michael Franti, Pacifica's Peace Watch, a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. Produced by Scott Gurian, engineered by Granger Helvey, consultants Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini, our editor Reem Kathuta. We had production assistance today from Sidrak Franklin of WPFW and Jim Bennett of KPFA, and help from Tom Gomez and Marco DeFuego of WBIX.org, Refugees and Exiles Radio, and Laurel Padgett-Seekins. We had web help from Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net and WebActive.com. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.
Chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa.